Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, good second breakfast, wherever you are. Welcome to the Boonified Experience Podcast. I am your host, Kyle, but really, people just call me Boona. This podcast focuses on the business side of esports, video games, and technology as a whole. If you're new here or returning and haven't done so already, please follow and or subscribe on your audio platform of choice. We are quite literally on every audio platform known to humankind, so there is zero chance for you to not be following already. If you also want to watch me get a little bit more animated and awkwardly reposition myself in my chair when I ask guest questions, please subscribe to my YouTube channel below with those post notifications on. That way, you're notified every time a new episode is dropped. If you're wanting even more access to the Boonified Experience podcast, please consider pledging to my Patreon page. We have multiple tiers of pledges, giving you everything from exclusive Discord roles, early access to episodes, and even being able to ask my guest questions at the end of the episode. I can't tell you how much it means that you're here with me today, so let's go ahead and get started with the show. Good afternoon, Ryan. How are you today?
Doing well. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad we were able to connect and do this. And even though we're in kind of like the middle, well, tail end, I wouldn't say middle, but tail end of a pandemic, it's kind of cool that we get to do this, you know, across state lines, not having to be anywhere all at one time. I'm a huge nerd for technology, so I'm absolutely really thrilled that this product came to fruition when it did, and happy we're able to do this, man.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you can say at the tail end of the pandemic, at least for us here in the States, right? There's still a lot of work to be done in other places, a lot of things going on, but it is nice to be getting back to some semblance of reality here.
You're right. You know, and speaking on that topic briefly, I had a friend who has a couple of businesses in Korea, and I remember when I was thinking about upgrading some of my computer parts and like some of my setup, he was like, because January and February was last year was kind of like, well, we know what's going on overseas. So if you're like in the market for anything, like anything remotely related technology, whether it's new graphics cards or new like parts, like do it now, because you'll be fine till August, September. But once that hits, like you're just going to be completely like shafted. So it's kind of hard to like not have tunnel vision, but it's good that we're making some bit of progress.
Yeah, for sure. Man.
Yeah. Well, this is honestly the first. I've worked with a few attorneys at my place of office, but one thing about esports that I've always been fascinated about is the legal end, or like is the legal side of it, because esports to me is like the wild, wild west. And so it's fascinating to me to like learn about what the legal end even looks like, you know, because I know the law sometimes has trouble catching up, and esports is a very like fast moving industry. And so, so thank you for being on. And so, for those who don't know, man, tell everyone a little bit about who you are and what do you do?
Yeah, so my name is Ryan Fairchild, and I am an attorney with the Brooks Pierce Law Firm based out of North Carolina. I started working in esports, specifically with players, when I first started out only back in 2017, coming up on 4 years now. So nearly 4 years that I've been doing this. And from there, it grew into working with content creators, traditional entertainment work, with you know other companies that support in the space, production companies, management companies, things like that. So that's now the majority of my practice. I also do some litigation, still some traditional, you know, business litigation. Brooks Pierce is sort of a full service firm with about 100 attorneys. All based here in North Carolina. So that's the short of it. I mean, that's the TLDR version. There's definitely a longer story to that, but that's the short of it.
Cool, man. Yeah, we'll probably poke around a few parts of it and the audience can piece it together. Like I was mentioning, esports is brand new. And so when you went to like study law, like was esports like ever on your radar to want to practice? Like, how did you kind of like get to where you are, like, I guess, whatever sort that is, you know?
Yeah. So let's step back a little bit, because, little Ryan, back when he was in high school, I worked at a mini golf and arcade place, and you know, I played in $5 buy-in tournaments. Mm-hmm. So if you talk about competitive gaming, it's existed for a long time. In fact, I think Will Pardon said, you know, there was like a Space Wars, or there was a game way back in like the 70s where they had a tournament. So, you know, you depends on how you sort of define esports, but the modern era, yeah, definitely more recent. Particularly, I feel like there was sort of a new stage with franchising in League of Legends and in Overwatch League. That was sort of a new phase of it. And I was actually just starting just as that was happening. But no, when I was in law school, I was anticipating, I went to law school because I wanted to do criminal justice reform. That's still something that's a big interest of mine. And while I was at law school, I had a professor who was a national litigator for the ACLU said, she said, I think you should try working in a mid-sized law firm. And I had had zero interest in working for a law firm because my picture was always the big New York firm, San Francisco, Los Angeles, that sort of thing. I was like, I don't want the soul crushing job, right? Like I want to actually enjoy my free time, have free time. So, you know, when she said that, it held a lot of weight because she was somebody who had been doing up until she became a professor, work that would have been right up my alley. And so she connected me to a law firm that I was like, oh, this is actually interesting work. And, you know, the hours are stringent, but it's doable. Yeah, so, yeah. You know, I went from there to gearing towards litigation and not taking anything, frankly, that really served me well for moving into esports. Like I did some cyberspace law, which sort of touched a little bit on some of the issues. But my only connection to esports at the time was I was playing a ton of Dota, watching a bunch of like professional StarCraft matches. Like I would have pro StarCraft and pro Dota on in the background of whenever I was studying. And so what happened, the reason I got into it is I did a clerkship after for a federal judge. So I came down here to Wilmington, North Carolina and did a clerkship for a judge. And when the clerkship ended, I actually had a chance to end early. My wife said, let's take the boys. We had our two boys at the time and let's travel through South America. And my work's remote. We can do slow travel. And so while we were doing that, you know, kind of living on the cheap and spending more time and, you know, we weren't doing the big touristy thing. We were doing slow travel. And while I was doing that, I read a lot about sort of the business of esports and was looking at kind of the interplay of the legal side and the economic side and was writing some and thinking about it. And so when I interviewed with Brooks Pierce, when we got back to the United States, I interviewed with Brooks Pierce and everybody asked me, well, if you could do anything, what would you do? And I apologize if you were picking up my kids in the background. But you know, that's our day and age, I guess, with the pandemic.
I have a dog that barks at every truck that goes by, so we may get it. She may introduce herself as well.
I hope so. That'll make me feel better about the stuff going on in the background. So after that, when I got to the law firm and interviewed, everybody asked if you could do anything, what would you do? I said esports. And everybody's like, what's esports? And I would explain sort of, you know, some of the demographics, what was going on and everything. And people would say, I still have no idea what you're talking about, but you know, some of that sounds really interesting. And if you can go get it, then you should pursue it. And so I took them at their word. And when my daughter was born, I had some time off. And so I called up one of the contacts who I'd been writing for. He was an editor at a magazine called Killscreen that was getting ready to publish a piece of mine until they sort of let go a lot of the longer form stuff. But I called Will Pardon, that was my buddy, and said, Will, can you connect me to anybody? Like, can you connect me to a player just to figure out how to do this stuff for free?
Sure.
And so all of that, coming back to your question, like I did not do anything to prepare. Like I didn't know what esports legal practice looked like at the time. So I had to learn all of the intellectual property work. I had to learn, you know, more contracts. Yeah. You look at contracts as a litigator, but it's always sort of like the post-mortem, right? Like you're looking at it after the fact and saying, okay, what went wrong here? You know, what are the arguments we can make, things like that. So, you know, I had to learn up the labor and employment stuff, Talent Agency Act, things that come into play all the time. licensing, really licensing of intellectual property rights being one of the biggest things. So yeah. I just wasn't equipped for it until I started doing it.
Until you kind of, that's cool. I feel like everyone that I've had a conversation with on this podcast that is involved in the scene, it was never like a, I wanted to do this. And so this is what I did. It was like, you like StarCraft, you had Dota Pro League on in the background, but you had your own like career path. And then like,
yeah,
there was this weird random like opportunity that you stumbled upon and you're just like, well, why not? You know? And so that's been kind of the story of a lot of people that I have interviewed on here. And so one thing that I have been curious about is like until today, you know, the economics of esports have been very like, it's very like hush hush on like how well the industry is actually doing, you know, and yeah. like, you know, economic, like how these companies are making money, what the contracts look like, player rights, you know, when it comes to like esports as a whole, you know, do you just kind of like, as someone who's in the industry, do you think that it's in a good spot, like economically, like, cause even though there's all this money being thrown into it, it's like, what do we have to show for it? And like, it's just not very clear.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really interesting question. Yeah, there's a lot of different places we could go with that. Sure. So, you know, I don't see teams' books. I don't know how they're doing. I know anecdotally, you know, when I hear here and there people mentioning things, but you know, I know that there are some teams who are making money. Yeah. You know, there was an announcement today. I'm guessing that TSM, you know, if they weren't in the black before, I'm guessing they're probably doing okay now.
Right.
So the issue though is publishers control all of the intellectual property for the games. And so any monetization that's featuring the games is going to flow through the publisher, who will control that revenue. And so teams really, in order to make money, they have to find other ways besides direct monetization of the game. So it's building a lifestyle brand and selling merchandise and doing sponsorships. Yep. Yeah. You got the 100 Thieves on.
Yeah.
It's trying to find other ways. So there are some teams who are, you know, trying to build technology platforms and trying to find that angle where, I sort of think of it like skateboarding and surfing brands. Like you've got O'Reilly and O'Neill and
yeah.
you've got Billabong and Mossimo and some of these, you know, we're talking about older brands at this point, Vans, who they started with a very specific niche product and then they created a lifestyle brand where it expanded out. And I actually think that's a really interesting sort of case study of businesses as well, is start with a niche, build your audience there, and then find ways to organically sort of grow from there. So esports, for example, a lot of people compare to sports. I actually think it's better just to think of sports and esports as separate verticals in the entertainment industry.
Got it.
Because at the end of the day, what you're really doing is trying to attract eyeballs, right? And so if you think about esports as a niche among entertainment, then it's like, okay, then our natural extensions are out into the entertainment space or out into the lifestyle brand space. Like think about what the natural extensions are. So going back to your question though, I don't know that competitive esports is built in a way that it could make a lot of money, at least not as structured right now. And at least not with publishers kind of exercising the degree of control they do, or in the case of Valve, the lack of control. You know, I kind of go back to my rules of esports. The first rule of esports is that the community determines what an esport is. It's not the publisher.
Yep.
It's the community. And that's why Smash Brothers, as much as Nintendo would probably love for it not to be a competitive game and just a game you play for fun with your friends and your kids and whatever, it's the community has blessed it and has lifted its status up to esport level. And you can build a game as a publisher and say, hey, we're going to make an esport and we're going to call it Overwatch and we're going to pump a bunch of money into it. And if the community isn't there, it doesn't matter what the publisher does. So, you know, hopefully Overwatch succeeds in some way or another, but really what publishers should be doing is not trying to create an esport. They should just try to create good games that a community is going to rally around, and then the community will determine if it's an esport.
Seems like a lot less pressure, like on the publisher in reality.
Yeah. And also just a lot less sort of outsourcing of risk to everybody else, I guess, by saying, okay, yeah, come buy franchises in our league and we'll see what happens. I always say StarCraft, one of the greatest esports ever, and Blizzard, what are they doing with it? Where is it? Why isn't it around? And maybe it's because you can't sell, eight-figure franchise fees around StarCraft.
Who knows? Unbelievable, man. Yeah. Yeah. When it comes to, it's interesting you talked about the verticals of the sports and esports. And I like that you made that comparison because, I mean, you look at the way traditional sports makes money, it's ticket sales, it's media rights deals, it's merchandise, it's this. And recently we've been seeing there's been chatter around media rights deals and how that could potentially be, esports is kind of saving grace, if you are. At least some people say that's the story and some people, don't really know, but.
Yeah, I don't really know either. A lot of the deals you see coming through Twitch and YouTube, but I think the problem is if you're just looking for eyeballs, go grab Shroud and some other big streamers and pay them X amount of dollars, which probably costs some fraction of what it does to operate an esports league. Because, Shroud's pulling in an arena's worth of people every single day.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. So if you're trying to get people to watch games, a lot of people would say just go through the influencers. Yeah. So, and that's, I think, one of the reasons why Activision Blizzard wanted to do in-person stuff was to get back to that sports model of, let's sell pour rights, let's sell merchandise, let's have it be an experience a day, go do an outing with the kids, that sort of thing as well. More of the spectacle and the physical location spectacle. But I still think that we should try to be more innovative with how we go about things. Personally, I think what would be really exciting is if, and I'm still a blockchain neophyte, but it seems like the key to sort of this industry, esports came out of map editors. It came out of Blizzard in particular, putting out tools where the community could come in and just make stuff. And out of that, you get Dota All-Stars and Dota Defense of the Ancients, and you get Tower Defense even, and you get all these other genres of games that emerge just from giving the community tools to build. Yeah. And then, from Dota comes League, even Counter-Strike and some of the things that have come out of there, there's a lot of community contribution there. So one of the things I've thought about is why not build some of this stuff onto the blockchain and just say, okay, if you go make money with this, built into the blockchain is some amount of, we get X percentage revenue back, and then just go wild. Do whatever you want.
Yeah.
And that way, the publisher who's put these tools out there makes some amount of money into perpetuity, but then otherwise allows the community, because again, it is the community who is building the esport, who is choosing what the esport is, who's going to be the fans, who's going to be doing all those things. MLG was originally just, how do we put on tournaments with this? How do we do these different things? Optic and, Optic was just, all right, let's make cool videos of us doing stuff. And so, copyright law, thanks to Disney is, gosh, I don't even remember, life of the creator plus 70 years, I think it is. It might be more than that. I got to look it up. Copyright life of, I'm going to Google this right now, plus how many years. I always forget this. I should know this. Yeah. But yeah, 70 years. Okay, I was right. All right, go me. See, what people don't know about lawyers is we don't actually know all the law. We just know how to look it up and we sort of have it here. So that seems weird. I'm going to go look some stuff up. That's actually what lawyers do. They look stuff up. because of that though, publishers before esports, their way of making money was I put a game out here and I capture all the revenue and I protect it from everybody. Don't go copying my game. Don't go copying my game. Don't go copying my game. If you copy my game, then I come at you with lawsuits and cease and desist and stuff like that. So esports comes along and it's this different model with like, we need to violate your copyright in order to have esports. Like we need to just build stuff. They're like, no, you can't do that. Like if we don't allow anybody, don't copy our game. Don't do anything with our game. And so there's this shifting in model that, again, like you were mentioning, I think that, you know, technology is always ahead of the law.
Yeah.
And the law, if anything, often slows technology down for better and worse. I mean, it's for both, right? Yeah. Like there are instances where the law is put in place in order to fix the bad things that happen as a result of technology or labor practices or whatever it is. But we're very slow at updating them and we're bad at responding to new technology. And so because of that, we, you know, sometimes can't have nice things.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, even, I was even having a discussion, the medical industry almost kind of, for a different reason, kind of suffers the same like lag in technology, was that their deal is privacy. You know, it's like, how do we keep customer data private? You know, and it's like every time a new era of technology comes out, it's like, well, how do we migrate that over? How do we, you know, like do that with always keeping the patient in mind? And it was kind of a fascinating, you know, discussion because I had no idea about the medical industry or anything about how our healthcare system works. Cause I think even the people who build it don't know how it works. you know, something that I did notice is like, you know, we had like, there's companies that like seem to get it or publishers that seem to just like get it when it comes to esports. And like, you look at, you know, League of Legends, I mean, and recently Valorant, I want to touch on that just a bit because I didn't know before last week much about Valorant. Like I knew it was a really hard game to play. I knew it was very similar to Counter-Strike. I knew it was a very peaky game.
Well, and carefully tell that to as well, because you know, Counter-Strike players are going to tell you Valorant's not an easier game. It is an easier game relative to Counter-Strike.
Relative to that. But again, I don't, you know, I'll share a little bit of my history on this. Like I'm a Halo kid. And so I grew up playing, you know, Halo CE, Halo 2, Halo 3. That was like my generation of what, you know, that's where I started gaming. And, you know, we kind of struggle with the same divide within the Halo community where it's like, I'm like what you consider a Halo boomer who likes just traditional movement, left, right, jump. There's no manipulation of mechanics. There's no, like, it's just shooting and moving and grenades and teamwork. That's it on a symmetrical map. But now you introduce a game like Halo 5 where there's, you know, sliding and thrusting and clamber and advanced movement. And like the community split. And one argues that, you know, with Halo CE through 3 in Reach, arguably you had to think more about your movement before you made a play. Whereas in Halo 5, you could, if you fucked up, like you could get yourself out of it, or you know, you could, like,
yeah,
you know, there's, but at the same time though, the skill ceiling when you add advanced mechanics
goes way up,
and you have players like Shotzi, and you have players like Frosty, and you have like these kids that just are brilliant and know how to manipulate the game.
Yeah.
But I go, that's kind of like, to me, the way Valorant is with, like, you know, see, that's just my perspective of it at least. But, to my point though, as a viewer or a very lightly skilled person in it, like that has no idea how the game truly works. Like I actually sat down and watched the Masters the entire week last week. And like, it was actually very entertaining for someone who knew, I didn't know everything about the game, but like knew very, very little. And they somehow found a way to keep someone like me entertained for an entire week. And not only entertained, but like I was hyped, man. Like I was like in it with the NA, EU, like all around the globe.
Oh, yeah.
It was a cool experience, man. But I look at games like that. And then I look at Call of Duty, where it's like, I grew up playing Call of Duty and it's franchise. And now they're, you know, they're eight figure, franchise deals. Yeah. Like, but it's not, unless it's my team that's playing, I don't really care about watching it. And there's like this question that bears, like, if we're trying to expand esports in this entertainment vertical, like how do we have to expand outside of gamers. I mean, that's just my take. How do we do that?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And well, like, you have that dynamic in other, going back to sports. And I want to point something out, by the way.
Yeah.
You just mentioned you were totally enthralled, even though you weren't watching it, right? Like you're not a deep fan,
sweaty player.
You had the storyline, the NA versus EU. Like again, esports is entertainment, right? It's storytelling. Mm. Like that's really what's going on there. So, you know, I tell people the same thing with sports. You have characters. You've got, you know, Trae Young versus the Knicks. There was the Knicks, you know, great feel good story, finally gets back to the playoffs, screw James Dolan. And then Trae Young comes in as the villain and puts on an amazing show, bows when he knows he's about to send them home, like has fantastic quotes. There's a story there, right? Like it's still entertainment at the end of the day, which is why, you know, the NBA never really cracks down that hard on refs because, you know, if people complain about them, that's still something to hook into.
That's you touched a nerve on that one, man. I'm a Houston Rockets fan, and I went to game 6 of the play. I think it was in 17 or 18. And that was just an experience I won't forget. It was game 7. It was actually game 7, Rockets versus Warriors, the Western Conference Finals. And it was, my mom got, like, I pressured my mom at the time to get tickets for us. And we were in the nosebleeds, like in the way far up, terrible seats. But it's like when you're there talking about what we mentioned earlier, like the experience, like there's nothing like being at a playoff game with a bunch of people that are just jazzed up and there's energy and there's goosebumps. But man, between the first half and the second half, it's like they completely swapped refs, or it's like they completely forgot everything they knew about basketball because they were so blatant about it. It wasn't that they just missed a few here and there that like changed the course of the game. It was like, it looked like they were deliberately throwing it. Like I say that as a passionate fan, but anyway, that created a massive storyline, you know? And so I don't know. That's a tough spot, but
well, there will never be, I think, anything as bad as I grew up in the Bay Area, by the way, so I'm a Warriors fan.
Yeah.
but there will never be anything as bad as Kobe Bryant elbowing Mike Bibby in the nose and Mike Bibby having a foul called on him for that. Like he's bleeding, like out of his nose, bleeding, has the foul called on. And that was, I think, Donaghy was one of the refs who worked that series where Sacramento should absolutely have won and it went to the Lakers. And, you know, that the NBA has no incentive to try to like do anything about that. Like it's just narrative for them. It's still narrative. So I never know if like the fix is actually in fully. And I've seen it go for my team. I've seen it go against my team.
Right.
But you know, it's still, there's a narrative there. But I wanted to go back to, you raised another point about Valorant and drawing in casual fans. That's what it was. Mm-hmm. So sports has this, right? Sports has, like, I've watched rugby and I get some rugby and, you know, with a little bit of explanation, I get a little deeper into it and I enjoy it. But, you know, I understand basketball much, much better than I understand rugby. Sure. I understand hockey, you know, better than rugby as well. So, and there are some people who are way more into basketball than I am. You know, you've got Zach Lowe like breaking down like the little things that happened in a game in the same way that I've heard like Dota coaches break down. Like I've got a client who's a Dota coach who one time was looking at replays and I said, okay, you know, why did this team win the game? And he goes, well, it happened right here at 2 minutes and 45 seconds when this guy makes this rotation at this time, they get this kill and the game's over.
Yeah.
I'm like, they played for another 25 minutes. Right. Like, how is it that? And he's like, oh no, because this gives them a level advantage, which then allows him to rotate, which then allows them to put pressure on this lane, which then does this stuff over here, and then it's over. And at that point, you can like never really recover unless your team just, you know, throws.
Sure.
So, you know, there's always going to be a stratification of fandom. I think one of the key questions is how accessible is your game? And how do you draw the fan in? I actually am shocked that they have not figured out how to do this for Call of Duty, because Call of Duty has such a big player base. It seems perfect for drawing in the casual fan to watch this. And I don't know what it is. I haven't figured that out. If I do, I can probably make this space a lot more money. But like with Overwatch, for example, you're starting with something that is incredibly hard to watch. And as much as the casters do to make it interesting, it is very difficult, even for me as somebody who plays the game, to get into. And then like Fortnite, for example, although I can't stand building in Fortnite, but like trying to watch like Fortnite World Championships, I was like, this is actually probably a worse viewer experience than Overwatch. And that's saying something.
Wow. I've never heard that before.
I think that Fortnite is... Fortnite is such a different construction of a game, and we could go all on to Fortnite. Like I sort of think Fortnite esports is dead, frankly.
Yeah.
But It's not a good watching experience for me unless you get it down to those last two. But before that, when you're jumping around, you don't know where you are on that platform and the storm's closing in around you. And oh gosh, it's a nightmare.
Yeah.
So
I think Warzone's done a decent job at when they do these casting tournaments or like how they do the tournaments and how they like have all the players with their live streams up, the graphics that display them. Like people bringing it back for context, like, you know, and because not everyone's in the same game. I don't know. I don't have the slightest clue how Fortnite competitive works. Like not Fortnite's a game that I've touched maybe a total of 2 hours, like total out of the entire time. Cause I just don't enjoy it. So I'm not going to go watch it. I just know that.
And I'll also be frank. I don't enjoy it because I die. Like there are 12-year-olds popping my head and I'm not doing anything.
Right.
So,
I mean, I come there for like, I respect Ninja for, you know, like having that moment with Drake to like make esports cool and gaming popular. And like, that's what I know about it. And I have respect for the game because I think that it allowed or it enabled, you know, a lot of growth, a lot of rapid growth, you know, from that moment. I respect it, but but yeah, you bring up an interesting point because like with Call of Duty, it just I love the game, but to me the way like the roster like and I don't know what the problem is here, but the way like the roster mania is right now that where they moved it from 5 players on a team to 4 players, like when a player gets benched, it almost like 90% of the time means that they are basically kicked off the team and they got to go find another team, and. Yeah. That to me, you know, when you draw a parallel to sports, like when you get put on the bench, you just get put on the bench and then you could go back in at any point in time.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? So that's the part with Call of Duty that I really struggle with is that like these players, how can they compete at their highest level, which takes a lot of skill, a lot of presence, a lot of awareness when they're worried about, am I going to get dropped tomorrow? Am I going to get benched? Yeah. Because you look at TJ Holly and you look at the Hook thing with Dallas and LA Thieves and like, you're just like, how can you, because TJ wasn't doing bad, you know, TJ was, he was playing like,
I mean, you had, shoot, it was the team who just won the championship where they dropped some of their roster too.
Empire.
So, I mean,
yeah, they dropped
Hook. Yeah, that's right.
They dropped Hook. And that was like,
yeah. What? Yeah. I mean, part of that is, there's a lot more process that goes into making a system stable. And there's also always money considerations, and teams in some ways I think have shot themselves in the foot by creating their own sort of arms race when they get into these things. I mean, frankly, and this is one of the hard things that I don't say a lot. We have, you know, sort of 4 traditional major sports leagues in the US, right? You've got NFL, NHL, MLB, and NBA. And MLS is coming up, right?
Yeah,
and
yeah,
maybe,
yeah.
You know, MLB is, you know, the S is going to replace the B in those big 4. But, you know, there are bowling leagues.
Yeah.
And not as many people watch them. And they don't get paid as much. There's professional darts and billiards and ultimate frisbee. Mm-hmm. There is actually professional ultimate frisbee.
I know that, yeah.
Yeah, and it does exist after college, apparently. So we have this stratification in traditional sports, and it exists in esports as well, but there are two difficult dynamics right now. One is that games tend to turn over quickly. And so trying to choose a winner of the video game battle royale, if you will, is difficult. So like, you know, battle royale genre is very easy to replicate. And so you had H1Z1 followed by PUBG, followed by Fortnite, which each one sort of successively kicked off the previous one as the king of the hill. PUBG still exists.
Yeah. PUBG Mobile's actually really hot right now too.
PUBG Mobile's huge. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you have like Apex Legends comes in, which I think is the most fun to play. But you know, and there are others that come out.
Yeah.
And so because of the nature of how easy it is to disrupt and how we haven't sort of calcified, it's hard to create stability. And I sort of worry about that long-term as well, because it's like, how do you, you know, baseball has been around for over 100 years, well over 100 years at this point. Basketball, you know, NBA, ABA merger was what, 70s? I don't remember exactly, but you know, 50 years since the merger, sport existed before that. NFL has been around for ages. You've had a lot of the growing pains in sports like happen, and you've sort of had the winners come out ahead. And so we're still in the phase of like, is it going to be CSGO or Valorant or both? Is it going to be League of Legends or Dota or both somehow? I don't think it's going to be Overwatch League long term, but you know, who knows? Maybe Blizzard finally figures it out. Maybe it will be Call of Duty. We haven't had that sort of stratification where we acknowledge that some things are just tier two, tier three esports and teams get out of them. I think that teams are still gambling a lot on what is going to win, and they're using a lot of that venture funds also to try to survive longer term. So the other issue, I guess that's really just kind of the issue, and there's just a bunch of sub issues with that.
Right. Right.
So
right.
You also, along with that, going back to the publisher point as well, like what's a publisher going to do with it? Like Dota, I think, could have put League of Legends in the dirt if Valve had done things differently like ages ago. And maybe there was a lawsuit that slowed them up, and so League got a foothold and everything. But CSGO was predominant as the FPS for a long time. And now Valorant looking pretty spicy.
It really is.
And having lots of people pushing over, and you're seeing the viewership numbers. And, you know, does Valve care enough about whether or not CSGO actually disappears to do anything about it? Because, again, going back to publishers having different incentives. Yeah. Valve's incentive is to get people onto Steam and to spend money on Steam. And so if Valve is like, well, shoot, we can't do it with Dota or CSGO anymore, better make a new game. Like maybe we'll actually go make Half-Life 3 and I will buy it. Like, can't leave me hanging like that ending at the end of Half-Life 2. Like the most emotionally traumatized I have been at the end of a game. Like just a grown man who was just sitting there like... Like I stayed up, like it was super late at night. I finished that game. I was up for like an hour and a half after just like thinking about it. Like I can't fall asleep.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if they eventually make Half-Life 3, shoot. Yeah. Sell it to me for $300. I'll pay that.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't been emotionally traumatized like that specific instance, but I'll tell you the first time I cried in a video game was in Gears of War 2. You know, when
I haven't played it. So,
I won't say. All you got to know is that if you are interested, even if it's because Gears of War is one of those.
Should we have a little spoiler section? Like if you're watching the podcast, spoiler section, we'll let you know when it's over again.
Right, or,
jump to the mark.
Yeah. Yeah. If you haven't played. Well, I mean, but to be fair, though, the game is over 10 years old. So, I mean, at this point in time, it's like
Star Wars.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Vader's Luke's dad.
Right.
Sorry, everybody who didn't know that.
Right. You know, like when Dom, like, yeah, are you going to play it first of all? Because I don't want to ruin it for you if you're going to play it.
I don't know.
Okay.
I've got such a backlog on games. Okay. So don't worry.
So you'll probably forget at the time, but Dom, like, find, like, his, like, he's, like, in this search for his wife because, like, the world's, like, overrun by locusts and the whole army. And, like, it's basically their job to, like, fight through that. And, you know, basically a lot of people have been wiped out. You know, it's just kind of like a newer, it's kind of like a different take on zombie apocalypse. It's just a different, same concept, same premise, but different take. But like he finds like his dead wife, and it was just like, but they do such, and for a game that was as old, arguably as old as Halo, like the storytelling in that game, the way I was attached, like Marcus and Cole and Dom and like these people, like I have an emotional connection with. So like when.
Yeah. You have a parasocial relationship with video game characters.
I do, man. And it was the first time that's ever happened, man. I'm like, first and foremost, especially at that time, you know, we were in a much different conversation with video games where we were still wondering if playing games with strangers on the internet was socially acceptable. You know what I mean? I remember my mom, like when I tried to like, I wanted to go to an esports competition. I got invited to play as an amateur on an amateur team as a substitute for a Halo 2 team. And like, I remember thinking about asking my mom, but I'm like, there's no way that my mom is going to let me go to Dallas to play video games with a bunch of strangers I met online, you know? So on top of that, it still felt very weird that I was experiencing that parasocial relationship with a fictional character.
I mean, but to be fair, like I read a lot of books and comic books and stuff. You do that all the time. Like you have TV shows. You're like, Yeah, you do that all the time. So don't be embarrassed by it.
We do. I mean, but it was at the time.
Very normal.
Today, I'm very comfortable with it. Like, and then it evolved to Game of Thrones. And then, you know, that whole emotional roller coaster for 8 seasons. You know?
Yeah.
I'm actually rewatching the series. I started.
Oh, man.
Just finished season one again. So, you know, I cried. I'm just like, oh, my God. Like, this is so heart wrenching. And they do such with the music and the story. Way off topic, but, you know.
When are we going to have that in esports? When are we going to cry over, you know, like, you know, Skadoodle, when he won, you know, there are definitely people who cried.
Yeah.
You know, he was crying. Other people were probably crying.
Well, even in COD, you know, when Priscini and Arcides were on the same team and then then one of them beat the other one. And like, it was like an emotional, like they cried on stage and it was like it was a huge deal, man. You know,
human experience, man.
Yeah. Which kind of like, I wonder because not that, but like, kind of reason I say I wonder is going back to the topic of like in-person events. Like I cannot wait to have in-person events again. Like they built like the esports arena here in Dallas. They, you know, I know they're building one up in Toronto. That's got all the fancy bells and whistles in it too. You know, there's a lot of things that are happening around that, but I know Activision like laid off a bunch of staff. Cause like they're wanting to change the direction of how if it's going to be virtual or in-person esports events happen. Like, I just wonder, like, are we going to have to choose whether it's more in person or online, or like what the relationship between online events like that also have the in-person element? Because like, I feel like esports has changed and I had a blast watching it online, but I just wonder if, are we just going to be so desperate to come back to in-person events that we're going to forget about, or not forget about, but put less attention to the online viewership? Or is there going to be like an evolution of both, like where they both like come together harmoniously and we have this like, I don't even know what I'm trying to say, but it's like this.
Yeah, no, I get it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I think, if you look at sports, there are a lot of people who watch TV, cable, whatever, streaming. And then there are a lot of people who go in person. And I think with esports, the question is not, will we hit that point and will we hit that model? I think the question is, will publishers actually continue to support esports in a way where we can actually see that happen? Because I think in-person events are absolutely key to esports one way or another. And I don't know that the right model is sort of the let's do sports where people are playing each other every week sort of a thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Versus sort of the let's do a lot of online play where then we come together for like a 3-day tournament or something like that, or we do a traveling tournament series or something like that. But I think the question is, will a publisher sort of support that or allow that? Because like Smash is going to live forever regardless of what Nintendo thinks. Smash is going to be played competitively forever regardless of like what Nintendo thinks.
Yep.
It's going to be, you know, even if it's small venues, like Evo to me is still like one of the greatest gaming experiences to go to. Like I used to work, like I said, at a mini golf arcade place long ago and playing those buy-in tournaments, and going back to Evo, I was like, oh, it literally hasn't changed in 20 years. It's just gotten bigger.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, and now we use a bullhorn instead of just yelling across. Like, you know, like they're still using paper brackets. They're still writing stuff in. Like,
that's the power of nostalgia, man. That is the power of nostalgia. Like, it's been done this way. It's always going to be done this way. It has, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Insane.
But like that, I mean, that's going to keep happening. Like, unless a publisher fully says like, no, you can't do it anymore, which doesn't really make a lot of sense for publishers just because it's free eyeballs on your game. It's free promotion.
Yeah.
So I think esports is always going to be live in some event always going to have live events in some way. Also, another thing I'll add too is a lot of people ask me who aren't familiar with the space and they'll say, oh, esports must be doing great during the pandemic. And I'm like, content creators, influencers are doing great. Like Twitch is doing great. Mm-hmm. YouTube's doing great. Anything where you're watching content, but esports is not doing well because live events are still the lifeblood of esports. I mean, that's really where esports is happening. So I think in one way or another, it will happen like that. It's just a question of, will the publishers allow it and support it? Like, will we have esports as we kind of know it right now? Will it grow? Will it develop?
Yeah. And that's Well, I mean, only time will tell, but like whatever this new normal will be, I think it's going to be an interesting thing for esports. But something that I like when you were talking, something that struck me, like when you were talking about, like, we still haven't really like calcified the space, or we're like, we haven't really like said, like, this is a tier one esport, this is a tier two esport, this is, like, you know, we haven't really defined that with like the games. I feel that it's a challenge, because with the way technology advances, I mean, like, there's players are always wanting something more. And if something evolves even more, you know, how are we ever going to get to that spot where it just says, like, you know, we all agree as a collective community, like, this is a tier one esport, this is a tier two. And like, I don't see that happening. And so it begs the question of, like, will everything just exist and nothing will ever become like that, like sports?
I think that's a possibility, honestly. And also, just, I have a thunderstorm going on, so if I just like cut out, don't be surprised.
Gotcha.
So I think that esports could exist in sort of its close to ideal form anywhere between, like, I used to say 5 years to never, and now I actually think it's farther out than that. I think it's like 10 years to never. Mm. And I know the space does move quickly, but I don't think that IP law changes quickly enough, and that publishers' mentalities change quickly enough. And with who we have in the space right now, like, unless, you know, a new challenger approaches or something like that, which happened with Fortnite, happened with Epic. So it could be that some publisher comes out with a new game where we're like, whoa, this is the game.
And you look at Halo Infinite, it hasn't been released yet. There's a lot of like,
hasn't been released yet. Yeah. There's a lot of hype around that. I definitely played some Halo in my day. Yeah. I actually had a roommate back in college who was sponsored and made some money from it back in the day. And I was like, wait, what?
Yeah.
Like, I was still kind of curious how that happened. And that was, you know, back in 2008 or something.
Yeah.
So, you know, I hope it happens, just because, like, I love esports. Like, I would actually love if I could focus more on this particular section of the entertainment world and didn't have to broaden my practice out to other places, just because it's so much fun.
Yeah.
Like, esports events are so much fun. They're so cool to go to. And for anybody watching who hasn't been to one, I mean, like, honestly, find a way to get to a Counter-Strike event, get to a Dota, whatever your game is, go find one, because they're a ton of fun.
It's funny, is as much as I've been a fan of the space, my very first event was the very traditional, like, MLG, where they did like two games at once in the same arena. It was Halo 5 and Gears of War, and it was like a $30 ticket in Louisiana. And I'm like, for the whole week, I'm like, oh, okay. But you're around a bunch of people, you know, around just a bunch of people with an extremely tight niche community. And I heard, now it's funny, as much of a Halo fan as I am, you know, and I am a fan of Gears of War as well, like, the side station at Gears of War across the arena was actually overshadowing the casters on the microphone with how much they were talking shit and how much they were like trash talking to each other. And it's like, I don't know, that to me, it just goes to show, like, those events are just incredible, and they're not at the point where it's like an NFL ticket where it's like $90 for the top section, you know. It's pretty, like, it's pretty mainstream,
it's reasonable.
Wanted to, you know, something that I've looked up recently is that, like, you know, talking about Valorant and zooming in on the Sentinels and then went like in them winning that whole issue with like Cloud9 and 10z or 10s or 10, I don't know how it's officially pronounced. So, you know, when it comes to like player contracts, I mean, it seems like we're in this era, and I'll give like one example that's kind of in the entertainment, but it's not in video games, where, you know, Dave Chappelle kind of put his foot in the ground with Netflix and said, said, stop doing this until I get paid. And they actually had to abide by it, even though he signed a contract, you know, that probably gave them the right to do whatever they wanted to do. He still had a community behind him that literally rallied and said,
yeah.
And they stopped. Therefore, the company lost profits. They had to abide, and he got his way. So when it comes to like the legal space and player contracts, like, how like fluid is that? You know, like, how binding are these contracts, and is it like, is that a major problem?
Yeah, well, that goes to a general question about contracts. So let's do a little legal 101 here, okay?
Gotcha.
So there are criminal laws, and then there are civil laws, and contracts fall all on the civil side of thing, as long as you're not doing anything illegal, right? As long as they're not touching, like, we're going to have a contract to like sell heroin to people.
Right.
Like, that's an illegal contract, which is void, by the way. Like, You can't make a contract to do that. But otherwise, you know, in our realm, you know, I haven't seen any sports contracts where people are contracting to sell heroin, thankfully.
All right, yeah, that's good. Yeah.
But yeah, good baseline.
Yeah.
So we're on the civil side. And then the civil side, their contract is like its own area within the civil side of law. And breaches of contract are not considered like morally bad things. They are not tortious. And torts are not cakes, but they are things like negligence, assault, you know, things that we basically consider bad as a society, but not so bad that we make them criminal.
Gotcha.
It's just like there are penalties associated with them, civil penalties. So money damages, typically things like
Got
that. Breaching a contract is not considered a moral failing. It's an economic decision. So with esports contracts, just with contracts generally, the law is sort of like a weird onion in that really your ability to sort of enforce things, it happens in layers. So if we take a contract, for example, there is the layer of what does the contract say? And then there's a layer of how do the parties actually act? And that, because for example, I tell people like a good contract will not save you from a bad org, but a badly worded contract could be saved from that by a good org. So like if the org treats you well, you know, who cares if it's a junk contract? Like as long as the expectations of the parties are met, then, you know, what's in the contract almost in some ways doesn't matter unless there's a dispute. I saw the dog.
Yeah. I was about to say, there she goes.
Yeah. We're going to get some barking soon.
Yeah, we may.
So after that, if something does go wrong, there's the question of like, all right, does the contract help us to resolve whatever the conflict is? And then there's the question of, do the parties actually follow it? And then if they don't follow it, is somebody willing to enforce the contract? Mm. And then if they do try to enforce the contract through legal means, does the court actually read the contract the way that you wanted it to be read or that you think it should be read? And then can you enforce whatever the court says? So the court says, yeah, you win. You need to get, you know, $20,000 from them. Can you get them to pay you that? Like, can you go collect on assets, things like that? So there's all these different layers that go into it. People are like, oh, I signed a contract. Like the contract is law and it is from on high and you must abide. And it's like, there's so much more going on there practically. So one question, now that we've sort of given
that
a little,
helps.
You know, legal 101 baseline is, are players willing to breach and take that risk in order to sort of take a stand and put up for something, right? So there are all sorts of issues too getting before that. Like, has a player read the contract? Do they know what's in the contract? Did the team mislead them about what's in the contract? Are you willing to like kind of put up or shut up when it comes time to enforce? There's that enforcement question, right? Like, there's fighting the uphill battle. Like, where if you signed a bad contract and you think like you were pressured into it, like duress is a really high standard to try to get out of a contract. Was it gun to your head? No, then it's going to be really tough.
Yeah.
If a gun was to your head, then, you know, maybe we've got a good argument. Right. But so there's all these dynamics that go into this, and at some point Tfue sued, sued FaZe Clan. And so we had that somebody was willing to try to enforce contract on their terms. And then there were some issues with what was in the contract. So a judge said, hey, this is governed by New York law. And Tfue was like, oh, that shouldn't matter. We should stay in California because, you know, I'm in Florida, they're in California. There's no real connection to New York. Judge in New York eventually said, nope, I get it. And then Tfue got some decisions that maybe he wouldn't have gotten in California. Maybe he would have.
Yep.
But eventually the party settled. And so you see those layers come into play of, okay, a player took a stand on a contract, tried to enforce it. Judge said some things that maybe the player didn't like. And then eventually we reached some sort of settlement. I really wish that case would have gone farther, but I'm sure for the parties, it was best for it to settle the way it did.
Yeah.
Probably
financially.
I haven't actually seen I haven't actually seen the terms of the settlement. I doubt anybody will see the terms of the settlement, but other than parties.
Yeah.
I would be very interested to see them though.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it kind of, it, you know, that makes sense. Cause I had a very kind of rich, even with my current day job, it's like my knowledge and my understanding of contracts was very like rigid, and there was no fluidity to it. And it was like, you know, like if this is, there's just so much in it, and it helps take a little bit of pressure off of it, because my view of it was like, there's so much pressure. Everything has to be exact, and it can't be broken, and it can't be this or that. But, you know, in reality though, like if no one ever takes a stand, then how will anyone ever be able to like decide what's right or wrong? You know, like if it's always going to stay the same, if it's never going to change, if no one tries to break the mold, you know, then we're always going to be thinking the same way. And that then thus becomes the norm, you know? So it's a weird topic. And I was kind of fascinated by, you know, the whole Tens thing with Sentinels, like the fact that he was able to compete, then he won, but then they had already signed the contract like before the Masters had even happened, apparently. You know what I mean?
Wait, who had signed the contract?
So Sentinels and Cloud9 supposedly like had like already had the contract like agreed to before the Masters.
I can't go into too much because sure. I know some inside baseball
okay.
stuff.
Gotcha. But, okay. Fair enough. So on that, you know, I saw one of your tweets recently. It was like, you know, you recently got, you're on the NALCS, I think it is. NALCS Players Association. And you had mentioned that like players associations were something that you had always had like a fascination in, you know, when you were studying law. Like, tell me a little bit about that, man.
Yeah. So it wasn't so much when I was studying law as when I was approaching esports.
Got it. Okay. Okay.
I mean, it was kind of a natural fit because criminal justice reform along with like labor issues, they sort of fit together well. But when I started looking into esports and realized sort of the dynamics with the publisher and the teams and the players, I was like, man, if you think about it, esports, really the product, if you will, is a combination of a video game and players coming together, and that forms the product. Like video games without high-skilled players, it's a different form of product. It is a video game just in and of itself. It's not an esport.
Yeah.
Players without a game, like they're not an esport either. Like, right. I don't even know what that is. So when you have the two together, that's really the product. And so my thought was, publishers have by and large the most power in the space. But after that, players do, because they're half the product.
Yep.
And they're the ones who the public is going to rally around.
Yep.
Unless teams get independent brand status, which they're working on. Because right now, I mean, you know, one of the things I was writing about back in this era was that fans focus much more on players than they did teams. So if a player moved to a different team, you followed the player.
Yeah.
And we see that some with like, you know, some people do that with, we call them fair weather fans, where they, you know, jump around wherever LeBron James is gone.
Yeah, they're LeBron fans.
Yeah. And then you had the people who burned his jersey whenever he went away from wherever. Yeah. You got the there dog jumping around. All right, I'll talk for a while. Oh, yeah. She's excited. Going back to what was my point? We were getting on to, oh yeah, players associations. Yeah. So, because you have the backing of the public by and large with the players, and because you're half the product, and because oftentimes the publishers, at least with like Valve tended to listen to players more than they would listen to teams. Epic, for example, like Epic, I think could have cared less if teams did not exist in that space. Like they saw them as absolute middlemen, just kind of ignored them. Which at first I was like, man, that's kind of mean. And then I thought about it more. I was like, no, that just makes sense with the way they're doing things. Yeah. Like, does Tiger Woods have a team? No, he just gets his own sponsors. So like, why would, you know, Fortnite is much more like a tennis circuit or a golf circuit. So why would you even, you know, entertain teams? We'll see. Yeah. Right now, the Players Association for the NALCS, like, we're more geared towards sort of the foundational work of just trying to keep the players better informed of what's going on, instead of having, like, you know, teams and the league being the main parties who are sort of talking to each other. We want to be in on all those conversations as well, so that we can have that voice for the players in those conversations, so that we can get information to take back to the players. And then from there, it's going to be, all right, what are the interests of the players that we need to start pursuing? And we're already having those conversations as well. Phil is doing a fantastic job as executive director. And I really think is like, I don't even think people realize how good Phil is for this particular position and why his background is so good for it. But he's crushing it out there.
That's awesome, man. And I think, you know, there's a lot to learn, like coming, because we've talked about like, will esports ever like Calcify and will there ever be like a standard? And there may not be. And so I look at, you know, companies that like, okay, what is the current meta? Like, what is like the current, like, where's the most eyeballs? Where is like, who are the leaders in the industry? And you look at like Riot and they seem to be doing okay. You know, they seem to be doing all right. And they seem to be the ones who are innovating the most in this space. And so it's this weird thing of like, it kind of makes me wonder though, like, 'cause if they're having all these conversations with the teams, but they also seem very like open to players' rights, you know, like it kind of makes you wonder like the, like why it all isn't just like one thing altogether. And I just, that kind of like, 'cause the publisher kind of seems to have like this relationship with the teams and they're approving this players association who also has a seat at the table. You know what I mean? So like,
well, we should be careful about how we word things too. Like, They initially helped to set up the Players Association, but it wasn't like they could give their blessing. The players still could have gone out and done that on their own, regardless of what Riot said. So I just want to make sure that's clear.
Okay. Got it. So yeah, it's just kind of a question that I had, but like, or just kind of like a thought, you know, just as someone who's like a spectator. But when it comes to like the Trailblazers and the team, and like, to me, it seems like they are the ones who are following, or they're creating the mold for other esports to follow. But I look at talking about Half-Life's, you know, when it comes to a game like Call of Duty, I mean, one of my things is like, one of the reasons why they haven't seemed to like, quote unquote, figure it out is that there's a new Call of Duty every single year. Like the game never gets enough time to mature. And that to me, like really irritates me as a fan, because I grew up in Modern Warfare 2, you know, and and I also like Black Ops 2, and I like, you know, the new Cold War, but you know, there was a lot of games in there that I thought were trash. But at the same time though, like you never give the devs, I feel like you're cheating everybody. Like you're cheating the pro players, you're cheating the devs, because the devs could have something in a pipeline a year and a half, 2 years down the road, but the game needs to mature and the competition needs to mature to a point where that becomes relevant, or like, how can we evolve it and how can we help?
Yeah.
'Cause we've proven that with Counter-Strike, it's like a 80 gazillion year old game, you know, and it's still one of the most viewed games. Like,
yep.
And the graphics are so terrible, but it has one of the highest viewer counts, you know, and it's still so popular.
That is the benefit, you know, Valve is great for some things. It's bad for, I think Valve, if they put more effort into their esports, could absolutely crush it.
Yeah.
Like absolutely crush it. I think Dota could return as, you know, the biggest MOBA. I think that Counter-Strike could be the biggest FPS. I think, you know, they could do a lot of things, but again, Valve's interests might not align with that.
Yeah.
And so until you get a publisher's interests aligned with the esport overall, and I think Riot is the closest to that instance, right? Like Riot wants to make it work. At least that's every indication and everything I've heard is that they want to make
their action show it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, maybe they're just trying to starve out the other publishers, and then they're like, we are esports.
Right.
But
gotta wonder.
Until you get that really good alignment of interests, you're not going to see fully fledged esports. So I've always said you're either going to need a change in intellectual property law, you're going to need a benevolent dictator of a publisher, and that's it really. Like it's going to be one of those two things. I think blockchain offers some interesting opportunities. Yep. Like I mentioned before, where maybe you put a game out on the blockchain and you say, okay, community, you can do whatever you want with this. Excuse me. And then we just get a certain amount of revenue that comes back because it's all, you know, on the ledger. But again, I'm a blockchain neophyte. I don't even know if that would work. Like my baseline reading is that it would. But I could be wrong. And so maybe somebody in the chat comes and tells me you're an idiot. Wouldn't be the first time. So
yeah, I mean, I've seen Twitter. I've seen your tweets sometimes, or the comments below your tweets. But you know, I kind of think I look at it from a different lens in in the, like, I feel like I look at it from a very small niche within the crypto community. Like, I'm very similar to you. I'm still very green. I haven't studied it for years. I know a lot of people who have, but I look at it more along the Ethereum and non-fungible token, you know, aspect of it, where, you know, because Call of Duty has, a lot of games have now, Fortnite, Call of Duty, Valorant, you know, have all proven that, like, people love to purchase digital items and prove digital ownership in game. Like, Valorant to me has some of the coolest skins out there, and no one can tell me otherwise.
Yeah.
And, like, I actually paid $100 for a package set. It was unbelievable, but, you know.
Oh, wow.
Because I bought the brand new green Vandal, all that set, but it's cool.
All right.
It's cool, man. Like, I appreciate digital art. Like, that's something I didn't know I appreciated before NFTs fully, like, came out. And now that you can have a way for people to get to have real ownership in that, that to me is special. And you can prove ownership on this chain. I look at it as we're going to get to the spot where, again, this is one element of it. You know, there's going to be deeper conversations around how the game is developed and how it's pushed out, but I look at it as more of these creator assets where, say, Fortnite makes a limited edition of 50 skins, you know, and then you can, number one, create a secondary market for those skins. But number two, what if those skins were able to be transferred to another game, on another weapon, on another, like, will games evolve to that point where you can, like, literally transfer that token and spray it on different guns, different players, different aspects of the game? And, like, it gets a little heady, but, like, that's the way I look at it, is that you create.
Yeah.
And then what if these publishers have these artists that can make their own money by creating these own skins? What happens to the publishers then? You know, so
yeah,
it's a very interesting topic, but I don't know. I haven't got to the point where I have a thesis on it, but, like, I think there's a huge cross-section between esports and gaming and just gaming in general and the blockchain. I think it plays a massive role in its development or in its growth.
Yeah, no, I think it'll be really interesting to watch. And I think we're an iteration away on NFTs in terms of being there.
Yeah.
Like, we're not there
yet. Yeah, we're not. No.
But we're one iteration away, I think. And it'll be interesting because you need the alignment of a lot of different things in order to do that.
Yeah.
But if it aligns, it's really exciting.
Yeah.
Like, if it does come in and align right, then it'll be really good.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, I mean, the thought of being able to take something between games even is really, really fascinating. And one thing I've always worried about on that angle is, are the publishers going to allow that? Because the publishers,
right,
I mean, they want to put each other out of business oftentimes. Like, I mean, if Activision Blizzard could say, you can only come to us for esports, I mean,
they'd do it.
You know, we're going to get rid of Riot and Valve. Why wouldn't they do it?
Yeah.
So I've always wondered about the incentives there too, because, again, going back to that model of, like, it's not intentional obsolescence with games, but there is the, we're going to release new games every year in case of COD. Mm-hmm. We're going to, you know, release new titles. And the old title is going to go away, like Nintendo, right? Like, they wish that they could delete Melee, right? Like, they wish that, like, Smash Ultimate were the only version that were out there, and they could, you know, somehow reach into my house and grab my N64 and chuck it. maybe not that bad, but what they want, see, because I always wonder, why wouldn't a publisher want to make you pay to move your stuff over or make you just buy new stuff again?
Right.
Like, hey, we just made virtual stuff, zero marginal cost to us. Why wouldn't we want to just do that all over again and make you pay money again?
Yep.
So there are probably people smarter than me figuring out how to solve that. But we'll see. Anyway, that's my big skepticism about it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, we literally was just announced today, like the partnership with, or not, I don't know, it's partnership, but it's like a naming change with TSM, you know, where they, I don't even know what you call that agreement, where it was like
the naming rights.
Yeah. The naming rights to that. I mean, that was, that's a huge.
So they do that for arenas in traditional sports, right?
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
It's fascinating to see. I think it's FTX.
FTX.
The network, like, they have a lot of financial terms. When I started looking up their information, that, like, I need to do some more research on, like, who they are and what they do. But, you know, that, regardless of, like, my knowledge of that specific coin and token and service that they're providing, like, just what has happened has to me, solved a lot of problems. Number one, it's the most public deal that has been like they've been very transparent about like what this means and how much it costs, you know, versus like, I know there was a Tencent, you know, Tencent owns a lot in the gaming space, and like they basically sold a media rights company to a company that they own majority ownership. And it's like, hey, like, is this a good deal? Oh yeah. Hey, okay. Yeah, sure. Let's make this. And then they publish it. And it's like, it's not, you know, it's two completely different companies merging together to hopefully solve a common problem. And
yeah,
I don't know. It's number one, it's the most public deal that's been made, but number two is that you know, it's the first, like, people are starting to get curious about cryptocurrency and gaming and how it can work. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, and like, if my read, like I said, if my superficial read on blockchain generally is correct, then like, it's going to be huge. It's going to be transformational. And I've had some really smart people who also, oh my gosh, can you hear all that or no?
Not loud, but I can't. It's kind of funny.
It's there. Yeah. Yeah, I feel like they've chosen like literally right outside the door to wrestle. Yeah. Like that's the only place in the house where they can wrestle is right outside the door.
Right.
And into the door from the sound of it even. So, yeah. So I've had some very smart people who aren't like, I hate to say cultists, but aren't crypto cultists.
Yeah. They
aren't the fanatics.
Call it what it is, yeah.
Who still say things like, I think this could be close to as transformational as the internet.
Yeah.
And it's like, that is a really big statement coming from some very smart people who I respect a lot. And I'm talking about people in like, I'm not talking about the evangelists who get onto podcasts and stuff.
Right.
I'm talking about some people who I trust in private conversations talking about this. And, I wasn't sure what I thought about it until I did start doing a little bit of reading. And I was like, okay, like the tech, I don't understand the tech,
but
if what they are saying about the tech is correct, then I could see how transformational it could be.
Yeah.
And so for esports, again, though, the question is, will a publisher put those rights out there onto a blockchain? Will somebody come out and say, all right, we're going to do this and we're going to see how it goes? Because my thought has always been, whichever publisher finally allows the community to just fully run with it and finds a way to take just some percentage, but otherwise lets it to run free, they're going to realize that they're going to make money forever.
Right.
They're going to make money forever.
Yeah. Smart contract. Yeah. Yeah.
Imagine if Nintendo could just get like 5% of Smash revenue, like, you know, prize pool, buy whatever it is. Yeah. Like, yeah, you can go do whatever with Smash and we get 5% of the monetary value.
Yeah.
Like, money forever.
Yeah.
Like,
and it happens it happens automatically. Like there's no, it doesn't pass through hands. It doesn't, like, you know, it happens and it just gets wired over. I can see that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. It's all there.
But on the flip side, from part of the previous conversation though, is like, okay, if the game digs, if the publishers dig in their heels and they say no, but the community rallies around this idea, will they ultimately force the hand? Is that how they get bought in, or they're going to be more proactive versus reactive when it comes to how this is adopted, if it gets adopted? You know what I mean? Because it still hasn't fully happened yet. So I don't want to speak too many things into the future that aren't true, but I want it to happen, but it hasn't happened. It's just something that you got to wonder. Cause right now I see a divide. I see people who understand the utility, who see the value behind it, who see what it could be. For me, I look at getting kind of like, I call them IRL people, like, but just like people outside of the gaming world, more practical people, with normal jobs, like how this will affect them in order to get buy-in, you know, to this space. And I look at it as like, what if a lot of people want like ethically sourced food, clothing, you know, there's a big deal around transparency around where these things are coming from, you know, NFTs and non-fungible tokens on the global supply chain. You know what I mean? Imagine if you went for a steak dinner at Fleming's and you knew exactly where that steak came from.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. And there's like, I was listening to a guy describe sort of how you need the verification nodes that sort of provide,
because
that seems to me to be like the hardest thing is you have to tie it to some reliable data source. Yep. And then Because, yeah, I think it could be transformational for news as well, like, which I actually think is a really big challenge we face right now.
I think so too.
Is authenticating news. So, like, you know, how can you actually get to a point where you're like, nope, actually fake news, like literally, like blockchain has shown it.
Yep.
But then the question becomes, who's creating the data and how are they controlling the data, right? Like, you need that. That's where you start to get your questions about the points coming in. So,
yeah. And they're all valid.
But no, I mean,
they're all valid.
Yeah.
You know, but I like that. It's a, thanks for indulging that part. It's a new kind of like area of interest. Cause I also see, like, if you look at, kind of like secondary, like trading skin markets, you know, I mean, CSGO has proved it. Call of Duty now is into it, you know, like that whole, I think that will create, we're in this era where like secondary, I think the secondary market is in its kind of like gold rush phase, and I'm hoping that it levels out and like we can see like a healthy stabilization in it. I think right now it's just we're in these things where GPUs are, you know, sold out before you can get them, and they're selling for $5,000.
Yeah.
And like, but I see there being a market like with NFTs and like valuable skins or like limited edition 100 Thieves, you know, like AR assault rifle skins. Or assault rifle skins that can be transferred anywhere and you can prove that you own it. I think that there's a huge, people can create like online digital shops or like a digital metaverse shop where you literally have like all of the rare collectible skins that you like bought and sold and like resell for people who really want them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a wild concept.
Yeah. No, it is. And it's going to be interesting. It's going to be really interesting to see what happens with all of that too. I think the environmental impact is still something where there are some open questions. I know with like coins, you know, you can do stake and you can take some of that out, but the processing capacity, I think, is something we're going to have to be thinking a lot about until, we basically get better processing.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, true.
We'll see what happens.
True, man. Last topic I want to touch on, man.
Oh boy.
It's an easy one for you, man. It's around the commotion in your house. I've seen a lot of your kids, Pokemon portraits. Tell me about that, man. Like, I gotta know more about that. How did that come up? And, you know, I love that, man.
Yeah. So actually I've got like my birthday drawing. There's Aizawa Sensei from My Hero Academia. And then, this is another one he did for a friend of mine.
That's so cool, man. Psyduck is a nostalgic character from my childhood.
Oh yeah. And so like, if you look at my wall right here too, I've got,
oh, that's cool.
I got the ones he did for me lined up. You can't quite get all of them, but yeah, no. So wait, what was the question though? Sorry, like, I was so hyped to show things.
Because like that kind of, that's like what made me very interested in, like when I was following your social media, like it was a mix of law, is a mix of like esports law, social issues law, and then your son commissions Pokemon. Like how did he get into that? And like, is he like kind of like, in a sense, building his own like brand around that? Or are you kind of like teaching him how to do that?
Oh yeah, no. So we've definitely talked about it some too. Yeah. And he's kind of the oldest soul 9-year-old I've ever met. Like, he's very introspective. Like, he'll listen to NPR and like ask me questions while he's listening and then come back like 2 days later and be like, so I was thinking about our conversation of last Tuesday, father. And you know, like just, you know, not quite that bad, but that sort of thing. Right. He'll have follow-up and he'll have actually thought deeply about these things. And, you know, he's thinking about, you know, he's 9 and he's thinking about what he wants to do when he's 18, 20, 30.
That's so cool.
Like he was looking into animation studios and he was like, oh, they get treated like junk. Maybe I don't want to be an anime animator. But the way it got started was he said, hey, dad, you should buy, you know, he was doing art. Like, I remember when he was like 3 and drawing Ninja Turtles. And I was like, I haven't seen a lot of 3-year-old Ninja Turtles, but I'm pretty sure these are better than other 3-year-old Ninja Turtles. And so, yeah, he came to me and he was like drawing Pokemon. He's like, hey, dad, why don't you buy some Pokemon from me? I'm like, fine, I'll pay you $5 if you draw me the 3 original starters. And so he drew me one and I was like, oh, you know, that's not bad, Bulbasaur. And then what happened actually was Charlie Yang, and Charlie Yang was my 3rd connection to esports. He's been a friend for a long time now. Charlie was just like teasing me on Twitter and for some reason drew a pseudo Wudo and said, hey, how do you like my pseudo Wudo? In the middle of like trying to roast me. I was like, where did this come from? And so Liam sees the pseudo Wudo and he's like, that's not a very good pseudo-wudo. And so I was like, oh, well, you should draw Charlie one and we'll send it to him and say that, you know, my 9-year-old thinks your pseudo-wudo is junk, Charlie, and here's how it's done. So he does that and I go post it. I'm in, you know, a Discord server with a bunch that Charlie sort of curates with a bunch of random esports people. And so I post it into the art part and I'm like, Liam drew this for Charlie, and I send it to Charlie on Twitter and he reposts it saying, this is the most beautiful thing I've ever received. And we mail it to him. And so we had people like asking like, oh, I want a Pokemon in the Discord server. And so I was like, they're like, how much? I'm like, look, I paid him $5 for three, pay him whatever you want.
Right.
And had three commissions, and then they posted them online, and then I retweeted them. And then I was like, you know, this is a really cool gift thing too. Like, yeah. So I was paying for his shipping.
Yeah.
And so I was like, look, in exchange for, and he actually told me this, he came up with the idea because he's altruistic apparently.
I love that.
He was like, Dad, you've been paying for my shipping. I'll let you have some commissions for free. And so I was like, fantastic. They're not technically free because I paid for your shipping, but I will, you know, get some for friends and clients and stuff like that. Cause it's cool. It's fun. Right. Yeah. Like, and they're actually decent. I mean, for a 9-year old, like, you know, some of them are, and they're creative ideas. I don't know if you saw the Wooloo that he did recently.
I didn't see that one yet,
but it was, I think I just retweeted when we sent it to it. So it was for a friend, Yen, and it was Snorlax dreaming. And so he had one cloud that just actually became a rain cloud, one cloud that then became like a Wooloo, you know, because they're fluffy. Yeah. And then one cloud that was like sort of the inception of like him dreaming this dream. Wow. And I was like, super creative, just fun. And he comes up with it all on his own. Like, he'll look at drawings. He does them freehand, but like, he comes up with all the backgrounds on his own. They're like aesthetically way better than like anything I could come up with. Like, and then actually there are things where like, I hadn't realized some of the stuff he'd done at first. So he did a Charmander for Yasuo, and he had this really cool like rainbow effect coming off of it. And I was like, that's a really cool rainbow effect. And then later I realized, I was like, those are Charizard's wings coming off of it. And I hadn't realized it at first.
Yeah.
So he does, you know, he'll do a lot of like the little sort of evolution thing and do them in cute ways.
That's cool, man.
Yeah. That's, no, they're a ton of fun.
Yeah. Cause like I had a friend like that, and we're still friends to this day. I've known him since elementary school. And I remember I was like so honored because he was putting art teachers to like shame in fourth grade. You know, like he was just pure raw talent, just incredible. And he actually built like a dragon's picture, and I bring it up every time. And this is like 20 years later into our friendship. And like, I really like want him to like sell that to me one day, but I literally got to draw. He allowed me to draw all the little ticks of grass in this like picture that was like this large. And I just felt so honored because I'm like, this is just an incredible piece of artwork, you know? And you could, I remember like we didn't talk for about five years. And then I remember connecting with him again. And I just remember, like, if you're not doing something with art, like, I'm going to be extremely upset because, like, the level of talent, especially like your boy, like, at that age, and he's already thinking introspectively, and he's already thinking a little bit business-minded, he's already thinking about, like, other people and how this affects them, like, that's a bright future, man, because I see a lot of kids in this day and age that are extremely entrepreneurial, and I feel like I missed that boat by, like, 3 or 4 years, like, I have a little bit of it, but like I look at some of like the 15 to 25 year olds, and I'm just like, this is kind of insane.
Wow, yeah.
with the level of like awareness that these young kids have to really like own their own talent and like create their own value and like build their own economies. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's insane.
No, it's shifting. It's definitely like the creator economy is definitely the thing right now that's in vogue. We'll see how it shifts, but
yeah, man.
Yeah.
Well, Ryan, that really, like, I think we covered a lot of different topics that jumped all over the place. I appreciate you coming on and doing this. But last thing I really want to end it with is that, you know, kind of like the question varies between the type of person I have or the industry of person I have on here. But it's like, with the legal industry, what do you think that kind of like the biggest challenge that you're facing right now? Like, what do you think the solution, or at least your idea of the solution is to propel that forward?
That's an interesting question. What is the biggest challenge right now? I still think it's the ownership of likeness and image rights And I think it's a lot of educating players and content creators on how valuable those rights are and getting them to buy into, because a lot of players, they just want to sign contracts and get paid and go play the game.
Yeah.
And trying to get those players who are going to really stand up and push back on some of those things, I think that's finding the whale players, the big players who are willing to really take a stand on that. So I think that's sort of the next big front. I think that's been the front that I've been interested in for a long time. I think players associations are going to potentially play a role in that.
Gotcha.
Overall industry though, like that, you know, that's very specific to me.
Sure.
And what I work on a day-to-day basis. I think industry wide, it's going to be, can we find a way to make the economics work? And is that like going back to that, like, do we have that stratification where some teams just get out of certain esports and decide which ones they think are winners and which ones they think aren't? Do we get some teams out of the space too? You know, is there consolidation? So we'll have to see, because I still think, like I said, you know, esports is 5 years or 10 years to never away from actually being in a place where it's sustainable and good. Some teams are figuring it out, but they're oftentimes doing it not just with the competitive side. I swear my children are not bleeding. They're alive. If you hear them, they're fine. This is normal. Do not call CPS. Plus, you all don't know where I live, so I'm good.
Like when I had puppies growing up, they would always, like when I was either playing a game or my mom was working from home, it was like they would choose the spot that was 2 foot away from whatever we were doing to just start playing and wrestling and start growling at each other. And it's like, there's a whole house, but you have to do it right here. You have to do it right here.
Right there. Yep.
Yep.
Yep. Nope. It's like, you know, I'll move somewhere else in the house to like read and get some quiet. And then they'll be like, hey, what are you doing? And I'm like,
trying to get away from you.
Yeah, you don't want to say it, but, you know, kids are great. Yeah. Especially when they're sleeping.
They are. Yeah, like so trust me, like with my pup, like she's a great people dog. She's great with humans, but when it comes to other dogs, she's very aggressive and she's not shy about showing it. So there's times where like I've had that thought.
It's like my kids too.
Yeah, dude.
No, just kidding.
It's a normal thought, man. I say that just to say, be easy on yourself, man.
Yeah.
Well, cool, man. Ryan, last question. Where can people find you if they don't know where you're at? Where are you the most active?
Twitter is probably the best place, @Fairchild, nice and easy. I swiped that at recently that wasn't being used. So
love it.
Yeah. @Fairchild, or you can Google Ryan Fairchild and I'm typically the top results. So pretty easy. And I had a scheduled tweet go out about the TSM FTX thing that I was waiting for prime time to show off. Right. So I'm going to go check how that did.
Cool, man. Cool. Well, hey Ryan, I hope you have a great rest of your day. And again, thanks so much for coming on, my friend.
Yeah, no problem.
All right.
Good to talk to you. Take care.